You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When you step off the dock onto Mackinac Island, you're setting foot on land with a long and troubled history for Michigan's first people. And there are new efforts underway now to get visitors to look past the fudge shops and the quaint homes to really appreciate the Native American history on this island that they call the Great Turtle. Eric Hemingway is Director of Archives and Records for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Eric, welcome back to Stateside.
Great to be back. Thank you for having me.
Tell us, how long have Native Americans been on what we now call Mackinac Island? Do we have any clear idea how far back?
Some believe that Mackinac Island is actually the genesis for the Anishinaabek, and the Anishinaabek are the Odawa, Ojibwe, and Potawatomi together. And some believe that that is where the first Anishinaabe was created. So if, in that sense, from the very beginning, time immemorial.
So, and extremely important then to the Anishinaabe, right?
Oh, very important. And scientific evidence has shown us people have been on the island for at least 2,000 to 3,000 years. So either way you look at it, Mackinac Island's history is very deep.
The history for these tribes on Mackinac Island took a heck of a bumpy turn once the United States government and Indian agents like Henry Schoolcraft came on the scene, didn't it?
It certainly did. And Mackinac always had a tumultuous history, even pre-contact before Europeans. And there was contest for the island when the Iroquois from the east would come and wage war against the Anishinaabek. And Mackinac would be one of these areas for contest. But yes, once the Americans came in after the War of 1812, and they were victorious in the war, they started to set some pretty hard policies towards the Anishinaabek and other Native nations.
And the Treaty of 1836, we have got to talk about that, a prime example. Tell us first what was in it. What did Schoolcraft promise the tribes?
The Washington, D.C. Treaty of 1836 is a living document. It's still being interpreted today. The tribes had to enter into these negotiations to avoid removal. That was the policy in the 1830s and 40s under the Indian Removal Act created by Andrew Jackson. They wanted to remove all Indians east of the Mississippi River to west of the Mississippi River to these lands deemed Indian territory, which was Kansas and Oklahoma. And the Odawa and the Ojibwe were on the slate to be removed. The Odawa were scheduled to be removed to Kansas. No offense to anybody from Kansas listening, but we sent scouts out there and they came back and said, no, we can't go out there. There's no water, no trees, and all of our ancestors are here in the Great Lakes.
So they say, we've got to stay here.
We have to stay here. Our livelihood is here. Our spirits are here. Our ancestors are here. Everything's here. So in order to avoid that removal, the tribes had to get into these treaties. And the Treaty of 1836, really I'm waiting for a movie to be made about this whole event because it has all the drama, characters, villains, heroes. The tribes, there's six bands, Grand River, Muskegon, Grand Traverse, Little Traverse, Mackinac, and Sault Ste. Marie, six distinct communities all come together to negotiate this treaty with the United States.
All right.
They all go to Washington, D.C. to negotiate the treaty. And earlier in 1836, the head Indian agent for the United States is a man by the name of Henry Schoolcraft. And Henry has a very convoluted, complicated history being an Indian agent in Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very ambitious individual and also a very self-serving one, in my opinion. This is who the tribes have to deal with. And if they don't get into this negotiation, the alternative is removal.
Off to Kansas. So what was it that the tribes had to agree to?
Well, the tribes had to primarily cede land. That was the main focus of these treaties between the tribes and the United States. And this is the same theme throughout the United States, is acquisition of land. So the tribes had to decide how much they were going to give up and what they were going to retain once they give up this land. The Treaty of 1836 sees those six communities cede approximately 16 million acres to the United States, roughly two-thirds of the state of Michigan. So huge amount of land.
When they went to sign the treaty, they found a very interesting article in that treaty.
The treaty was negotiated in D.C., took weeks. So they ceded 16 million acres, but they got to retain lands and rights to those ceded territories. So they retained lands, which we call reservations today, but they also retain rights to hunt and gather on the ceded territory, and also monies from the land ceded. So this is what the tribes got to keep in exchange for all the land.
But there's a but coming, isn't there?
There's a big but coming. They agree to this, and Article 2 is inserted into this treaty. And Article 2 simply states, after 5 years, the president may remove said Indians. This is very temporary. This is not permanent. This isn't land for future generations. But Henry Schoolcraft assures the tribes that it'll never be implemented. He has their back. But what can the tribes do? If they don't sign this thing, the army will likely be sent up to evict them.
Hmm. So they sign. So then what happened 2 years later?
So they signed the treaty, and under tribal governance, they said, we have to ratify this in front of our communities. So bring the treaty back to Michigan in the summer when the ice breaks up, and we want to sign this in front of our communities. And Henry does that, and he brings the treaty to Mackinac Island in July of 1836. And over 4,000 Anishinaabeg go to the island to witness this event that's going to dictate their lives to the present day. And they bring the treaty back, and they sign it. And there is some very strong concern about Article 2. But again, Schoolcraft reassures them that this won't happen under his watch. And 2 years later, in 1838, Schoolcraft is writing our communities telling us it's time for you to pick your lands in Kansas.
Wow. Pack up, huh?
Pack up and go.
Well, what happened?
Well, we didn't go. We
stayed. Yes, I was going to say, you're here.
We're here. We knew our rights, and there were some very key individuals who stepped forward for the tribes. They knew what the treaty meant. They knew the language, and they had the leadership behind them to advocate for the tribes' rights under those treaties. And as the wording was in Article 2, the president may, this one word is huge, the president may remove said Indians. And they knew this, that the president never issued this definitive order to remove the Anishinaabeg. But Henry Schoolcraft was pushing it, and we would push back and say, well, where's the president's executive order on this? He never issued it.
A lot of tensions.
Huge tensions. So the five-year provision is up in 1841. The tribes here know this. They're very keen to this. And in 1841, communities within northern Michigan start to send petitions and letters to Congress, to the president, urging him to not remove these communities out west. So they're very proactive. They do what they need to do in order to stay home.
And in the midst of all of this, and it worked because, as you say, we didn't go. You're not in Kansas. In the midst of this, a woman named Agatha Biddle. Who was Agatha, and why was she so important to Native American history on Mackinac Island?
Well, Agatha, she's an interesting character in the fact that her lifetime is basically the span of the 19th century. She sees all of these incredible changes occurring to her people. She lives on Mackinac Island. She's not only witnessing these events like the battles on the island during the War of 1812, the treaty being brought there to be ratified by the communities, but she's also a leader within the Odawa community. She's actually a chief.
Yes, we should note that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
The Odawa and Ojibwe, they had female chiefs, and they had female leadership coming out of Mackinac, and Agatha was one of the chiefs. And not only was she one of the chiefs of the Mackinac bands, she also ran her own business. So she was an entrepreneur, she was a leader, but she was also very involved in the community. If people needed meals, she would feed them. She would take in kids that needed a home, sort of like an impromptu foster home mm-hmm. within the community.
And Agatha Biddle's house still stands, right? The oldest structure on Mackinac Island, and you're going to turn that to the centerpiece of telling the Native American story on Mackinac.
Yes, so Agatha's house was built approximately 1780. To my knowledge, it's one of the oldest structures in Michigan that's still standing. We've had just an excellent working relationship with the Mackinac State Historic Parks on helping to tell the story of Mackinac from all viewpoints. We worked on a plethora of projects. We did a signage project around Mackinac Island last year with Phil Porter and his staff. He's the executive director at the parks. We've done repatriations of human remains with the parks. So we have a good track record with them, and this just seemed like the next logical step in our work relationship is we need to tell more of the story of the Anishinaabeg on the island. It just was a logical choice that we use Agatha in her home and to tell this story through Agatha's lens.
So Agatha's house will be kind of that centerpiece. People can visit that and learn. And then the six markers placed all around the road ringing the island, telling what important things?
Well, the markers, we want to cover as much history as possible, given the space. So there's stories about pre-contact Mackinac. There's, you know, a really rich, deep history that predates the 1600s with the arrival of the French. It goes back thousands of years. And as you go around the island, you're going to see contests for the island. There's all these multiple battles that take place for the island, whether it be Iroquois against Odawa and Ojibwe, American British and Anishinaabeg. And you keep going around, and you're going to see signs about the treaty itself. We have one sign just about the treaty era. And then you come back around the island, and we're going to look at some of the more contemporary history of the island, some of the fishing rights that were so prevalent in the 1970s and 80s in the Great Lakes with native fishermen in the state of Michigan. And we end it with the ancestors, that, you know, Mackinac Island has always been a special place because the ancestors were interred there. And they still have a special place for Anishinaabek to this very day with special ceremonies that we hold honoring our ancestors, what we call ghost suppers. So we take it all the way full circle around the island.
Eric, in a nutshell, what do you hope the visitors to Mackinac Island will take away from seeing these markers, thinking about what they represent, and also from being able to eventually visit the Biddle House?
Well, I just hope that they take away, you know, a greater awareness of what Michigan is, who is Michigan in a sense, that it's not just one or two groups, that there's a lot of different people that call Michigan home, but the people that call Michigan home first were the Anishinaabek, and their story is not left in the past. It's brought to the very present day, and that we're still here, and that people, you know, come to recognize that, yeah, you know, this is a special place, and these are all the reasons for that.
Eric Hemingway is with the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, where he's director of archives and records. Eric, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me back on again.